Thank you, Pastor Montgomery, and it's good to have you out this Friday evening. And I've been looking forward to this evening also. I'm not quite sure what questions you people are preparing for me. He's worried about keeping me on my toes. Listen, I live on my toes. When you teach in Bible college and seminary, you never know what question's coming next. And so we'll just sort of get started here and see how we get along. If you have your Bibles, open them, please, to the book of Romans again, to chapter 6. Romans chapter 6. While you're turning there, let's recap just a little bit what we've discovered from the book of Romans thus far since Wednesday evening. We found, first of all, in chapter 3 that all have sinned. Paul makes it very clear, nobody can say, I've never sinned. We're all guilty of sin. And secondly, we found in chapter 5, because all have sinned, all must die. Remember the statistics I gave you? One out of every person dies. We're all going down that road. We have Hebrews 9:27 said, it is appointed unto man once to die, and after this, the judgment. So we're all going to die, and we're all going to the judgment where we will give an account to the Lord. Then we found from chapter 6, verse 16, he said, know ye not that to whom you yield yourselves as servants to obey, that's whose servant you are. And so we found out we get to choose our servant. Each one of us here this evening is one of two masters. I'm sorry, you get to choose your master, and that's whose servant you are. And then we found out last night that the standard of God's righteousness is deliverance from sin. The lowest rung of the ladder you can live on as a child of God is to be living above sin. We talked about confession last night and repentance. And, of course, after you've done the repenting, you've told God you're going to change and you mean it, you believe him to save you, and he does. Let me start this evening by saying to you, first of all, that when a person prays through at an altar of prayer, at that moment, they're ready for heaven. They've walked in all the light they understand. There's not another thing they need to do, much like the thief on the cross. Have you ever thought of him? Here's a man who we don't know that he'd ever met the Lord before. He may have. Scripture doesn't say that he did. There's Christ hanging on the central cross. There are these two robbers. Initially, they both rail on him. And then later one of them notices something different about that one on the center cross. And after a while, he looks over to Jesus and he says, Lord, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom. And that wasn't going through all the steps we talked about last night, but apparently it was enough because our Lord turned to him and he said, verily, verily, I say unto thee, today thou shalt be with me in paradise. And that was as far as that man knew to go spiritually. He had done everything he knew to do, and I'm sure we'll meet him in heaven someday. Say, well, he never heard a sermon on holiness. He doesn't know anything about holiness. Doesn't know anything about walking in light beyond that. Well, he never had an opportunity. He just walked in all that he could, and that was enough. So understand, when you pray through at an altar of prayer, wherever that altar is, at that point, you've done all that you know to do. You've confessed every sin that you're aware of. You've asked God to fix you up in every way that God can fix you up. And I like to liken you at that time to a large jar with a large mouth in it with a number of stones inside, and then someone fills that thing with water. Now, I would ask you, is the jar full? And it's running over, running down the side, right? So, yeah, you can't put any more water in it. I guess it's full. Fact of the matter, those stones are displacing some space in there, which is keeping that jar from being as full as it could be, but for the moment it's full. So nobody would say to a newborn convert who's just prayed through, oh, you need to kneel down and do some more digging, there's more you need to do. No, at that point he's done all he knows. And he may go for weeks and months just basking in the light of his newfound joy. His name is written down in the Lamb's Book of Life. In fact, when he prayed through, four things have happened. Again, nobody stands there and counts them out to him. But do you know what has happened when you prayed through at an altar? The first thing that happened is you were justified. Now, that means that your record in heaven was wiped clean. All of your sins were marked canceled or paid in full, or however you want to think about it. And as long as you walk in the light, that's the last time you'll ever face those sins. We say that you are justified. One old armchair theologian said, justification, he said, it's just as if I'd never sinned. And that's how it is. Your record is clear. Your jar is full of water. You're walking in all the light. Another thing happens at that very same split second. God not only wipes your record clear in heaven, but he also regenerates you. He makes you a brand new person in Christ. Same split second. He's justified you by removing your sin record in heaven, and he's given you a brand new life within. We call it regeneration. Like a newborn babe, you're a newborn babe in Christ. You have new desires, new appetites, and so forth. The third thing that happens in that same split second is he adopts you into the heavenly family. Now, you and I are related. Did you know that? Be careful how you talk about me, friend. We're relatives. Actually, we're relatives twice, because we're all born Adam and Eve's descendants, and really through Noah and Mrs. Noah, we're all related. But if you're here this evening and you're a child of God, you're my brother or you're my sister. This is a family thing. We've been adopted into the heavenly family, and Jesus Christ is our elder brother, so we got new family relationships. Again, this all happens at that same split second. And then the last thing is what I want to talk to you about this evening, and that is the process of holiness has begun at that very instant in your life. People walk up to me, and they say, well, is this thing of holiness, is it gradual, or is it instantaneous? I remember I pulled onto the campground in central Indiana, the state of Indiana, and I was unpacking, getting ready to move into where we were going to stay for that 10-day camp meeting. And my coworker came up to me and sort of with a impish grin on his face, he said, well, he said, are you crisis or are you process? Are you crisis or are you process? That was his way of saying, are you instantaneous or are you gradual? Well, he knew the answer. The answer is yes to both of them. The Bible teaches that there is a process of growing into holiness, and then there is a moment when it happens, when it becomes instantaneous. In fact, I have a little quote here that I wrote down. In 1766, that's where most of us were born, in 1766, John Wesley wrote to his brother Charles Wesley. These are the founders of the Methodist Church, by the way, over in England. And I found this interesting. Some of you more advanced people, you'll pick up on this. John said to Charles, he said, Charles, you press the instantaneous blessing, then I shall have more time for my peculiar calling, enforcing the gradual work. So he said, when you're out preaching, he says, you stress that it is instantaneous. And then he said, and I'll come along, and when I have a chance to preach, he said, I'll show them that it's also gradual. It's both. It is gradual. And it is instantaneous. And I hope you'll understand that by the time I'm done this evening. Now, I read you that verse the other night from Hebrews 12. And it said in 12:14, follow peace with all men and holiness without which no man shall see the Lord. Now, a lot of people have taught that as though it says, unless you're entirely sanctified and have both works of grace working, you can't go to heaven. The verse doesn't say that. It says you are to follow after peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. And when you stand up from that altar where you prayed through to get saved, you are what we call initially sanctified. The process has already started, and you're as holy as you know about being at that particular moment. Now, you're going to walk with God for days and weeks, maybe months. In fact, I've heard people say for years. Enjoying their newfound sonship, glad that the record is clear, they're witnessing to others, but little by little over a process of time, they discover there's still something in their heart that causes them problems. Now, what is this thing in their heart? Well, technically, it's original sin. The old preachers used to call it the old man, the carnal heart, the remains of sin. Name it what you will. That's those stones in the jar I was talking about. That's what keeps you from being completely filled. And so the process began the moment you prayed through, And if you were to fall over dead before you walked out of the church, you'd go to heaven. Because at that point, you're doing all that you know to do, and that's all you can do. You can't do anything more than walk in all your light, friend. And let me let you in on something. You can't walk in my light, and I can't get by trying to walk in your light. I've stood in front of a class in Bible college and said, students, you guys can get by a lot easier than I can, because as I've been walking with the Lord a whole lot longer. I've got a lot more light than you do. So I can't expect you students to be walking in my light, but I can't get by trying to walk in your light, because your light is probably far more limited than I. The longer you walk with God, the more he reveals to you, the more he shows you things about yourself, new discoveries and so forth, and you'll start making progress. So what I'd like to do this evening then is, first of all, I've asked you to turn to Romans chapter 6, verse 16. For the sake of time, I'm just going to read one verse. It's a verse you've heard of before many times. Romans 6, 6, and here's what it says. Knowing this, that our old man is crucified with him, that the body of sin might be destroyed, that henceforth we should not serve sin. Jesus said in Matthew 5:48, be ye therefore perfect, as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. I've said to my students, just add a little adjective in there and that'll take away all the doubt. Jesus is saying to these people, be therefore morally perfect. I'm here to tell you tonight, you can live a morally perfect life. You can't be as perfect as God, that's absolute perfection. You can't be as perfect as angels, that's angelic perfection. You can't even be as perfect as Adam was before they fell in the garden. That would be Adamic perfection. But you can have what we call Christian perfection or moral perfection. That's where you walk in all the light. That's when you make all those choices we talked about the other night that have any moral value attached to them. You get light on it. You ask God what you should do, and he tells you what to do. If you do it, you're walking in the light, and you're really in a state of moral perfection. Now, there are many, many verses in the New Testament. It talks about leaving behind the first principles of the gospel. Let us go on to perfection, Hebrews 6:1. 1 Thessalonians 5:23 says a verse that says, I was thinking of another verse. I just went from it. Help me out. And the very God of peace sanctify you wholly. And I pray, God, your whole soul, body and spirit be preserved blameless to the day of the Lord. There's a lot of verses that talk about sanctification, holiness, perfection. They're all talking about the same thing, just using a little different perspective, coming at it from a slightly different angle. Now, Paul says, knowing that our old man is crucified. Let me talk to you for just a moment about a crucifixion. First of all, understand that crucifixion and execution are not the same thing. Did you catch that? Executions and crucifixions are not the same thing. I did a paper one time in graduate school on Roman methods of execution, and they were masters at torturing people while they killed them. I heard one time down, if you visualize Italy, is that boot that hangs down in the Mediterranean Sea on the map, and then beyond that toe is Sicily. And in the city of Syracuse in Sicily, there was a little local uprising against the Romans one time, and they sent a legion down there. And they went out into a field, and they put 400 posts in the ground in rows, just like you'd see it in a military cemetery, if you will. Lined up 400 posts. They stuck out of the ground about 3.5-4 feet, and they sharpened to a point on top. And then they went into the city and selected 400 men at random and brought them out in that field, and two or three of these soldiers would pick them up and just jam them down over that point, literally impale them right where their legs come together. Just the whole trunk of their body was just jammed down over that post, and they just let them hang there till they die. Now, we know how our Lord was crucified on a cross, probably an upright with a cross beam. So the Romans were great at crucifying people, and they liked to prolong it, kind of make an example out of the ones who were dying. That's why they did these 400 men. They wanted the rest of the city to see what they had done, and it had an enormous impact, as you can imagine. So just crucifying somebody doesn't mean they're dead. In the case of our Lord, he hung on that central cross from 9 o'clock in the morning until 3 in the afternoon. Now, it's interesting, when 3 o'clock got there, he said something like this. He said to the Father, he said, "Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit." And then he said, the scripture says, he bowed his head and dismissed his spirit. That's how the original reads there. In other words, he had said throughout his ministry, nobody's going to kill me. He said, I lay down my life voluntarily. And he actually chose the moment to leave that body. He bowed his head and dismissed his spirit, and he died. So he lasted for 6 hours on the cross. The other men, we know that because it was a Friday evening and the next day being a Sabbath, they particularly wanted these men off the cross. So still alive, they would come up with a large mallet and smash their femur, the large bone in their upper leg, hoping that the fracture would have some shards of bone and perhaps would rip into some of the arterial, the femoral artery or vein or something, and they'd bleed to death to hasten their dying. Otherwise, those men might have hung there for 2 or 3 days. So my point is, Paul says, our old man is crucified. So what I want you to understand is, when you pray through at that altar, the old man in your life, and I have to be gender neutral here, it might be the old lady, okay? Your old man or your old lady, depending what your gender is, goes on the cross. And the death process has started, which may be cut short very quickly, or it may drag on for months or years, depending on how fast you cooperate with God while he tries to cleanse that nature out of you. That is kind of the fifth columnist of your soul, that enemy, that traitor that lives within you, that will make life miserable for you and might even make you miserable to live with. So this evening, what I would like to do is take a little time and give you some attributes, some snapshots of how this old man operates. And I'm going to do that with a series of illustrations. Now, stick with me this evening. Let's say for you, after you've prayed through and God has saved you, and you now can testify that you're one of God's children, and the process has started, and your old man has been crucified, and every time you see one of those carnal traits, you want to do something to get rid of it, the process has begun in your life. I would first of all point out this evening that this old man is an easily offended old man. Have you worked with anybody or been around somebody who's easily offended? You understand what I'm talking about? We say that they're touchy. Do you like to be around touchy people? We say they carry their feelings on the end of their fingertips. You tell them a story meant to be humorous, they always take it wrong. No matter what you meant, they'll put a bad spin on it. After a while, you just stop telling them jokes because they always take it wrong. Or they always think you've got some loaded motive behind it. They're negative because they're easily offended. They live most of their life up in the miff tree, and it doesn't take too much to send them up there. I've worked with people like that. I've watched people like that. I have pastored people like that. Sometimes I'll go into a church for a revival, and I'll notice maybe on the bulletin board in the back, I'll see some of the listings of the church officers. Maybe here's the Sunday school board, and it gives the members, or here's the pastor's advisory board or the finance committee. Now, this old man, if his name is up there, and his name doesn't happen to be the first one at the top of the list, he'll notice that. If he's two or three down, he'll wonder why he wasn't put up there as number one. Or maybe he takes ill, he gets sick, and he expects the pastor to beat a path to his door right away to come call him. After all, he's sick, right? And if the pastor doesn't come soon enough, he'll notice that. He may say, "Don't worry about me, pastor," but deep down in, he's feeling bad about that. You know why? Because he's an easily offended old man. He's touchy. You don't like being around people like that any more than I do. My first church started off in a storefront in downtown Hagerstown, Maryland, just a block or two from the square. I mean, Hagerstown's a pretty large city. A couple of interstates there. Old U.S. Highway 40 went through right down through downtown. We were just a block off Route 40. The old church was no church at all. It had been a butcher shop at one time. How'd you like to have church in a butcher shop? No central air conditioning on a hot August night when the sun was baking on that place. I could almost smell the old fat cooking up out of that oak floorboards. I can almost see where the old butcher stood to bone his the meat, you know. And here was a one-way street beside us with a red light right outside the door, and they'd stop there and gun their engines and peel out, and there was no parking. We lived in a little apartment upstairs, no insulation, noisy, cold, steel folding chairs, vinyl floor. Had one restroom in the place. How would you like to have a church with one restroom? But it gets interesting, because the restroom was not in the back of the church, it was in the front of the church behind a curtain. We didn't have a lot of visits to the restroom during the sermons usually. It took a lot of courage to go up there. And it gets even funnier because that building is now on the historic register of old buildings now. I think it was the oldest building in Hagerstown. The old door in the restroom didn't fit very well, and it had those old plumbing fixtures in there, ancient looking stuff. And if somebody went to the restroom, you could hear everything that happened in the restroom. Everything. And I've said to my students, I've had many a masterpiece of a sermon literally go down the drain halfway through my morning sermon. Well, in that situation, we had a family. The sad thing is, the woman of the house was our church treasurer. And not only that, she looked like a very fine holiness lady, but her old woman was still alive. She was easily offended. You know how I found out? One Sunday, we hadn't been there very long, and I said to her husband, I said, why don't you all come over to our place Sunday for dinner? It was a week or two away. Let me just do a little sidebar here and tell you, men, if you're going to invite a family for Sunday dinner, at some point, it might be better if you tell your wife what you've done. She might have a vested interest in knowing that you've invited guests for dinner. How I forgot it, I don't know. Saturday night, before they were to be there, it's about 10:30 at night. We're sitting in our little living room upstairs, this place, and I said, honey, what are we having for dinner tomorrow? Well, she said, I don't know, you know, the usual, whatever. She said, why do you ask? I said, well, you know, I've invited. She said, what? You've invited a whole family and you haven't told? Didn't I tell? No, she said, as a matter of fact, you didn't. And we were living on $10 a week then, and frankly, the cupboard wasn't all that full. And she said, I really don't know how I could entertain. Well, I called the husband. He said, no problem. I said, we'll make it another time. He said, let's do it another time. That'll be fine. But it wasn't fine with his wife. She was a Southern lady. Oh, she took that as a personal affront. How dare a preacher invite us to a meal and not tell his wife and then cancel on us? She came into church that Sunday morning. When she walked in that old lead glass door in kind of a diagonal corner of the building in there and she came in, it was obvious to everybody in the church she was in a bad mood. She just sort of sent out those negative vibes. Boy, she was fit to be tied. And she was talking to people about it, and this thing's getting out. In my old teeny Sunday school, maybe 25 or 30 people, and she's all hot under the collar about this because she's easily offended. We had an old retired preacher in the church at that time who was visiting, and he said to us Sunday night, she still wasn't over at Sunday night, he said, well, why don't we go over in the Sunday school room? I had framed a wall down the middle, two befores and drywall, and we had one Sunday school room. And so we went over to that Sunday school room, the adults, and I did everything but get out on the floor and beg this woman for her forgiveness, simply because I'd forgotten to tell my wife. And she looked at me finally at one end of the table and I was sitting at the other, and here's what she said. Well, preacher, she said, I'll forgive you, but I'll be a long time forgetting it. I say he's an easily offended old man. Now, we spot these traits in other people, but we don't seem to notice them in ourself. He's not only an easily offended old man or old woman, he's a fault-finding old man. This guy will just sort of hang around the church, or this old lady will just sort of hang around the church looking for problems, looking for trouble. If there's some dirt in the church, they love to sniff it out. They like a good story. This person reminds me of one of the birds that Noah sent out from the ark. Do you remember after Noah had built the ark and they're floating up there after all these days, and finally the waters begin to subside, but he's not sure just how far the waters have gone down. And in this world of decay, everybody that had lived had died now. There was a lot of decay, putrefaction taking place. And it says that Noah opened the window of the ark, and he took a raven. A raven. Do you know what a raven is? A raven is like a buzzard, a turkey vulture. Do you know what ravens like to eat? Roadkill. The more rotten it is, the more smelly it is, the more they like it. And he took that raven and put him outside the ark, and it says that raven, and I can just see that raven hovering around on those big wings, and he says, wow, look at the rot, look at the filth, count me in, man, I'm here. And he never came back to the ark. He liked what he found. Well, sometime later, he sent out a dove, that beautiful, pure, white dove, a symbol of the Holy Spirit. And the dove went out and flew around for a while and says, nothing out here for me. Count me out. She came back to the ark. And then later he sent her out again. Finally, she brought back an olive leaf. Now things are getting back to the way the earth can be inhabited. And then finally, she didn't come back at all. Well, that old raven makes me think of some people I've seen in some churches. Fault-finding, critical, censorious. The preacher's too long-winded, he's too brief, he's too deep, he's too shallow. The Sunday school teacher couldn't get her act together, the special music wasn't any good. And they just pick and pick and pick. And then this spills over into their children. They'll go home and complain and pick at everything that happened in the church. I heard a little kid one time went to church, and he hears his mom and dad doing this. And on the way home, they were still criticizing. His older sister got involved. Finally, at the dinner table, there's still a little bit more going on. And he piped up, the little boy, and he said, well, he said, if you ask me, it was a pretty good show for a nickel. That was his take on things. I heard of a church one time that had a sign over the archway where you leave the sanctuary. And this church's sign said, you entered without knocking. Please leave the same way. Interesting. I'm sure that there's some churches, some places that probably need a sign like that. But anyhow, he's a fault-finding, censorious old man. He just gets out his microscope and looks around, looking for trouble. And you know, if you look for trouble, you can find it. None of us are perfect. We're all imperfect vessels. We do the best we can with God's help. And love covers a multitude of sins. Love will cover a multitude of faults. There are some people that go into a church and everything's wrong, but they don't see a thing. Boy, they say it was a good service today. Thank God, you know. Well, these people got something in their heart that this old man needs, this fault-finding, critical old man. He's a bitter old man. A bitter old man. When I was a graduate student at Kent State University, I worked for a bitter old man. You won't know him, so I can share his name. It's Dr. Schwartz. I was a teaching fellow. I had a four-year scholarship, and I was giving lectures, grading papers, doing my own sections and so forth. And I'd been a part-time student for several years, teaching at Allegheny Wesleyan, pastoring a church, and finally I got a teaching fellowship. I was up on the ninth floor of the library one day, and a fellow came up to me, and he said, Kaufman, he said, you're one of the guys that got fellowship. Yeah, I said, I am. Well, he said, I'm graduating in a couple of weeks. He said, let me give you a little advice before I leave. He said, there are two professors in that history department, or 27 PhDs over there, and he said, there are two of them. He said, I'm going to give you some good advice. Stay away from them. Don't take any of their classes. Don't work with them on committees. Just give them lots of room, and life will be a whole lot easier for you. And he mentioned two of them. Walked off, and I never saw the guy again. He graduated and left. I have no idea where he went. A couple of months later, I got my letter in the mail from the chairman of the department. Oh, congratulations. You got one of the two fellowships this year, and on and on and on. And they said, and we'll let you choose who you work with on the faculty. But he said, the first semester, we always assign you the one you'll work with. So he said, I've picked for you Dr. Schwartz, one of the two guys that I was told to stay away from. He's an old Jewish man. He'd never been married. He's a bachelor. He was raised in downtown New York City by two unmarried aunts. No father figure in his life. Brilliant, PhD from Harvard. But this guy just sort of hated the whole world in general and students in particular. And he's got tenure. He's there to stay. And he said one time, he said to the chairman of the department, and I said, students, he said, I hate them, they hate me, what's new, let's get on with life. So this is what I get to look forward to for the next semester. I said to my wife, I said, honey, but he's got a soul. He's going to face God someday. I said, I'm going to do what I can. I'm going to pray for him and at least have a decent relationship with him. Well, interesting enough, I had two things going for me. One is I knew Hebrew, and that positively intrigued him, why a Methodist preacher would ever want to learn Hebrew, and he's Jewish. And then I wore a jacket and tie to class, and that impressed him, because most of the guys wore muscle shirts, you know, and pretty claddy looking. And he was always neat as a pin. So he kind of tolerated me for a while. And as I worked with him over the months of that fall semester, he finally said to me one day, he said, I'm taking you out for lunch on Thursday. He didn't say, would you like to go to lunch? He said, I'm taking you out to lunch, like it's a direct order. Yes, sir, Dr. Schwartz. 12:30, Bowman Hall. I'll be in a white Buick. I'll pick you up. Yes, sir. Aye, aye, Captain. I'll be there. And that's the way he operated. We got in that car, drove into downtown Akron. He took me to the most expensive restaurant I've ever been in my life. I mean, this place is white velvet carpet. This is where they stand around with white towels over their arms, you know, for lunch. Everything's crystal, silver. This is upper crust stuff, and obviously he's a regular. They all knew him. They took us back into this dining room, and he said, get anything you want on the menu. Get anything you want. Get a steak. Yes, sir. I'll get a steak. It's lunchtime, but I'll get a steak. He's paying for it. I'm a man under orders. And they started bringing the food. Now, what do you do when you go out to lunch before you start eating your lunch? I might just pause and ask you that. What if it's an agnostic or atheistic Jewish professor who hates the whole world in general and students in particular? Well, I said, Dr. Schwartz, I said, I'll tell you what I'm not like. No, that's not the way I want to say it. Let me just give you my illustration. I heard of a boy who joined the Army. He's off in boot camp. And the rough, tough friends around him noticed that he prayed every day before his noon meal. So here he is in the dining hall, the mess hall, I guess they called it. He's got his tray, he sits down, he bows his head and prays. They notice him. Finally, one day, just as he looks up from praying, this rough, tough guy up on the other side of the table yells down at him where everybody can hear him. Say, hey, farm boy, he said, everybody do that where you came from? And the farm boy looked up and said, no, he said, the hogs don't. It's not a bad answer, is it? That shut that fellow down for a while. He had nothing more to say. No, I said, the hogs don't. I said to Dr. Schwartz, I said, do you say bracha? Now, I was in a little bit of a dilemma because Jews do a blessing after they eat. We Christians, we tend to pray before we eat. Nah, I said, I'm not into that. So I said, well, if you'll pardon me, I said, I'm going to say a little table grace here. And I bowed my head and silently prayed over my meal. As I was looking down, I could feel his eyes boring into my forehead. And when I looked up, he said, well, what did you say? So we talked about my prayer for a little bit. This is a bitter old man. I've met them. They're not all in the halls of academia either, by the way. I've met some in the church. I had a lady who was a preacher's wife in my church. That woman was so hateful, she actually helped run people off from the church for me. A preacher's wife. I'd shake hands with her. How you doing? Huh? Okay. Not very good. It's terrible. Nobody wanted to be around her. Just criticize, find fault. Now, you know, the New Testament love chapter says love suffers long and is kind. Sometimes I feel like preaching, Lord, give us a revival on just kindness. Teach us to be kind. He's a bitter old man. This old man has a keen sense of humor. The more you humor him, the more he likes it. That's his idea of humor, doing what he wants done. He's an envious old fellow. He's a jealous old woman. She'll sit in church, and if somebody walks in with a new dress, she'll notice that right away. Then she'll say, well, who does she think she is to be wearing a new dress? Or he'll look out the church window and see somebody walk in and drive in a new auto. Well, who do they think they are? This is how he feeds himself. This is what he lives for. Envy. Jealous. Notice what I'm describing to you thus far. These are all internalized. Do you know you could be sitting in church and be the most jealous person on earth and none of us would know it? It may leak out a little bit. Basically, this is stuff that God is going to have to deal with you about. You might be a good actor and you might be fairly successful at covering these characteristics up, but they're there nonetheless. He's a man-fearing old man. You know what? I've said many times, and I believe it as much as I ever did, a lot of people are going to miss heaven because they're afraid of what people think. They know what they ought to do. They know what they want to do, but they're so afraid of family members, working companions on the job, neighbors. They can't bring themselves to do what they know they ought to do, even what they want to do, because they are man-fearers. And do you know the book of Revelation, clear over in the end of the Bible, tells us, John the Revelator gives us a list of people who are not going to be in heaven. He says, for without the gates are, and you know who's first on the list? The fearful. Afraid to testify. Afraid to pray in public. Afraid to do anything lest you be identified with the cause of Christ. And you'll never amount to a hill of beans spiritually as long as you're afraid of what people think. When I was in the U.S. Air Force during Vietnam, I was an X-ray technician. When I enlisted, I already was working in X-ray. And when they found out about it in boot camp, they cut orders for me to a hospital in Wichita, Kansas, where I spent the balance of my four-year enlistment. Now, in that radiology department, are you with me? In that radiology department, we had a supply closet. And in that supply closet, we had a lot of stuff in there that looked interesting to me. We had a whole row of some kind of insect spray. Like an insect fly spray or something used to kill flies or mosquitoes or whatever. Old army drab green with stenciled name on it. And we had a mountain of masking tape in there. It was really autoclave tape. You nurses know what I'm talking about. When you wrap something up and autoclave it, the stripes turn black when they reach 212 degrees. So I'm standing here looking at this stuff and I'm thinking, well, I work for Uncle Sam. He kind of owns me. He owns this. So this stuff and me, we're sort of mutual, and if he owns it, I own it. And through some convoluted reasoning, I thought somehow I could help myself. And I took one of those cans of fly spray and three or four rolls of that masking tape and took them home with me one night after work. And I've asked my wife in 48 years since then, I don't think we ever used the stuff. I don't know what happened to it. I just talked myself that it would be okay to take it, and I went home, never saw it again. Months and months went by. Several years went by. Finally, my enlistment was up, and I came back to Salem, living in Ohio, and I'm trying to live for the Lord. And one day, I was on my knees praying in my private devotions, and as though it were swinging on a string in front of me was a can of fly spray and a few rolls of masking tape. And I thought, oh, no, surely not. Lord, you might... Yes, I do remember. Lord, surely you're not going to expect me to do something about that now. And so I just tried to pray around it. But you know, when God starts dealing with you about something, you can't pray around it or over it or under it. The next morning I tried praying again, and I wasn't very far in my prayer, and here came the fly spray and the masking tape. Now, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but I figured out I'm probably not going to go much further spiritually till I do something about this stuff that I'd taken. So the devil starts in on me now. Oh, boy, that's appropriating federal property. You know, and I'm starting to think in terms of the FBI and Alcatraz and Sing Sing and Fort Leavenworth and irons and chains and, you know, the end of my life. And, man, anything but that. And we're not talking about the local 5 and 10 cent store. We're talking about federal property. But God just wouldn't let me go. So finally I sat down at my old Smith Corona manual typewriter, and I hammered out a letter. I addressed it to the Byrd Colonel. Full Colonel was the head of the 835th Tactical Hospital, McConnell Air Force Base, Wichita, Kansas, to whom it may concern. And I went on and said I had taken this property so many years ago, and here I think is the value of it, and I wrote out a check for something like $8.50. And I was working for $2.50 an hour in those days, and that wasn't heavy bread, as we said. And so I wasn't in the mood to give him too much extra, but I made a check for $8.50. I was sure that would cover it. Put the thing in the envelope, put a stamp on it, dropped it in the mail, and sat back and waited for the FBI to turn up on my doorstep. Well, a few days went by. A few weeks went by, and then I think a month or two went by. Frankly, I'd forgotten about it. And by the way, my praying was going much better. I was getting along well in my prayer life because I'd done what I was supposed to do. I say he's a man-fearing old man. Scared or not, I'm going to do what I got to do. And here's what I like to say, people. You can trust the consequences of your obedience to God. You can trust the consequences of your obedience to God. If God wanted me to start a jail ministry from Fort Leavenworth, I'm ready to be the new teacher. Whatever God had for me, I was willing to leave it with him. One day I got this big, long letter in the mail, this envelope. It didn't have a stamp on it. It had some federal franking, you know. This thing had come from the federal government. And it's typed out very neatly to Mr. Paul Kaufman and so forth. And I opened it up. I still have the letter. It was an interesting letter. What that letter really said to me was this. That letter said, Mr. Kaufman, we received your letter, and this check and your letter has been on every base in this Air Force hospital, and nobody wants to touch it with a 10-foot pole. Nobody knows what to do with it. There's no way for accounting for these funds. And so finally, some poor second lieutenant supply officer got the job of sitting down and typing me a letter, and he basically said, we don't know what to do with it. Thanks for your efforts. Good luck in your civilian life, and sincerely yours. And out fell my check. Now, the devil had me running scared for weeks, but I decided I was going to do the right thing whether or not. And, you know, every once in a while, I don't know why, I get some perverse pleasure, particularly when I feel the hot breath of the devil. I just get back in that old file cabinet, and I pull out that old envelope and letter that's now turning about half yellow. And I just want to say, there, Satan, take a look at that again. You tried to scare me away from the victory. But he's a man-fearing old man. That doesn't mean you won't have stage fright or some disaster. If a tornado is bearing down on your house, you won't feel some fear. I'm not talking about that. But I'm talking about what the Bible says, the fear of man worketh a snare. And some people don't go very far spiritually, because they can't get beyond the relatives or the friends, the colleagues at work, and so forth. He's a stubborn old man. Oh, I've watched this one operate on the church board, on the conference board. You've seen it on the job. Let me tell you something, friend. Compromise is not always a bad word. It doesn't hurt to give a little bit in a discussion. I've heard it said that building campaigns can be dangerous for a church. That's true. Our little country church of Mount Calvary was going to put new carpeting in. Now, what color should the new carpeting be? Well, you ask 20 people and you get 20 different colors. Obviously, not everybody's going to be pleased. Well, our pastor very wisely got 3 samples of what he thought would be close enough to somebody could find something like in each one. And one Wednesday night after prayer meeting, he laid them up front and he said, now, we'll vote on these, a secret ballot. And the sample that gets the most votes, that'll be it. And we did it, and we didn't have a problem. Not everybody liked what was there, but that was the agreement, and we got along fine. But he's a stubborn old man. I went to a church as a boy in Canton, Ohio, that ran up to 350 on Sunday. Easter, Christmas, we'd get up to close to 500. That old Canton First Church, I remember they bought the house next door, tore the house down, put in some beams, and expanded the church that way. It was on a street corner, couldn't go this way. And they just expanded in every way they could. There was no more room to expand. So they bought a lot up on 17th and Broad, put aside their money, and was going to build a new church. My uncle was chairman of the building committee. He was a union carpenter, could have had his own business, was very successful, did a lot of commercial carpentry work. And he was going to be the chairman, and he had his idea of how to do things. The pastor's son was a masonry contractor, and he had his idea how things ought to go. And I mean, every decision they had to make, these guys were button heads on the board. And they weren't smart enough to keep it in the committee. It got out in among the various families, and people were talking about it. It ended up they built a church that would seat 450, And I'd been there during a ministerial when they had 450 people in there. It'll hold it very nicely on the seats. You don't have to stand in the aisles. And that church that ran 400 and 500 today runs about 45, maybe 50 people. And I'll tell you what, psychologically it's devastating when you get up to preach to 35, 40, 50 people in a church that'll seat 450. Or you invite outsiders that come in, they see all those empty pews, they wonder what's wrong here. I'd rather have a smaller church and fill it up than have something like that. But my point is, here were two adult, supposedly Christian men who just couldn't agree. Stubborn. Neither one would back down. Had to be his way or the highway. And you see the results of it. Makes me think of that old goat we had home on the farm. I grew up on a farm. We had about 100 head of sheep. Had about 100 head of Hereford cattle. One year, my dad said, "Boys," he said, "we got that 15-acre woods back there. It's all grown up with underbrush and so forth." He said, "We're going to fence it in and put the sheep back there." So my brother and I had the job all that summer back there digging post holes and stringing wire to fence in 15 acres of that woods. Poison ivy all over the place. We both are very allergic to poison ivy. We lived with blisters and swollen eyes, and it was a mess. And I see these guys with their fancy PTO-driven augers, you know. We didn't have anything like that. We had a spud bar and one of these things, you know. I mean, it was slow going, and there was plenty of rock in there, too. But finally, by the end of August, we got the barbed wire fence around it, about 10 strands of barbed wire. And Dad said, "We're going to put the sheep back there for the fall to clean that thing up." But we had dog packs running around. Dad said, "We're going to put the old goat back there with him, too." This old goat, he would fight dogs when the sheep wouldn't. Sheep would run from the dog, he'd stay and fight. In fact, he was an ornery critter. My brother and I had personal experience with him. Many times in the winter, when we had those things in the straw shed, we'd be at one end of that pen, we'd be putting hay down in the manger, and you know, you had bales and sections, and we'd bend over to straighten up those bales, and every time we'd bend over, that old boy would draw a bead on us. Man, he'd be airborne. He'd hit us like 90-mile-an-hour runaway train, we'd go flying. Then he'd just stand there and shake his head and stare at us like, "What are you going to do about it?" Mean. Stubborn. So we put the sheep back there. About the time we went back to school in September, we put the sheep back there, and boy, they mowed the grass. They cleaned that place up. They ate about anything that would grow within their reach. The place looked like a park late in November. Now Dad says it's time to bring the sheep up to the main pasture for winter. And so here's what we had to do. Our house sat up on a bank on one side of the road. Across the road behind me were all the other buildings, the granary, the corn crib, the machine shed, the garage, and the gate that went into the big pasture was there at the end of the garage. So we had potential for traffic coming through, so my sisters and my mom would get out there, and they'd hold back cars while we'd bring the sheep up the road. So get the picture here now. Now, sheep will follow each other. If you can get one sheep to go through that gate, the others will follow. And sure enough, first thing you know, all 100 sheep have gone right through the gate, and they're having fun in the pasture, and that old goat is just standing there. He can't see that gate. If he can see it, he's not about to go through it. Then he decided to have a little fun. He took off running up the road, my brother and I off after him, chasing him, round in and out of buildings, behind buildings, got him back down to the gate, and he took off another way, and I mean, we're getting tired, and my mom and sisters are holding back traffic, and everybody's watching the show. And finally, my dad says, "Hold everything. I'm going to teach this boy a lesson." So he marched in the house and got his old J.C. Higgins 12-gauge shotgun. Came down to the end of the walk, and he's standing across the road on the other side up on that top step. And that goat is over there by that machine shed, standing in front of the gate, just staring at him. Like, "What are you going to do about it?" My dad pulled up that shotgun. He's going to teach him a lesson, see? Pulls up that shotgun, boom, lets one go. The goat made a sound I'd never heard before in all my years. It went something like this. It was like, "Bleh." And that thing fell to the ground, dead as a rock when he hit the ground. I mean, he was dead. Now here's my dad standing over there with a shotgun. The smoke's curling out of the side of the chamber, a little bit of smoke coming out of the barrel. And I'll never forget my dad's words. He said, "Oh, for pity's sakes." Like, I didn't mean it to go that far. So we had to go get our knives and butcher the goat standing there in the gate, and we had goat meat all that winter. Wasn't that bad. Every time I see a goat, though, I think of that stubborn old man. People, it's not always wrong to compromise once in a while, particularly within the church. There are some issues you can give a little on. Some people just can't see that, though. He's a selfish old man. Do you like to be around people who are selfish? Have you noticed it? Do you ever watch people at a Sunday school picnic digging through the best cuts for theirs? They got to have the biggest piece of pie, the biggest piece of cake. We had a young couple got saved in our church, and they had an only child. My heart kind of goes out to the only child because they don't learn to interact and share with other young people. When all you have are adults, and we talk about that with our own granddaughter, somehow we got to start teaching her to share. Because when they get into school, the other kids aren't going to put up with that. They're used to sharing. Nobody likes around people selfish. Well, when we built the addition on the parsonage, I put a big kitchen in for my wife. Put about 16 feet of countertop one way and, I don't know, 12 or 14 the other way. And we'd love to have people come over Wednesday night after service. Sometimes we'd have just the seniors over. Sometimes just the young people. We'd find different groups. It's kind of hard to get the whole church over there, but we just really enjoyed fellowshipping with people. My wife would have some soft drinks, you know, maybe sloppy joes, potato chip, whatever, cake, pizza. And we'd get in the kitchen and she'd say, now over here's where you start. Here's the paper plate, you know, and here's the drinks and here's the ice. And then we'll just sit wherever. And this little 5 or 6 year old girl, doesn't matter where anybody else was standing, she'd always elbow to the front of the line. And as soon as we'd pray, she'd jump the head of the line. She'd get the biggest piece of cake. She'd grab the biggest sandwich, whatever, and march off to the living room and sit in the biggest chair like she was the queen herself. And I said to my wife, I said, that poor girl is just being programmed for disaster. It's not going to go well with her. To this day, I think it's hard for her to make friends. She's bright, but she has no social skills at all. She just grew up being catered to, learned to be selfish. Now, that's one thing when you see it in a 5-year-old, but it's different when you see it in an adult. It's sad, because that old man is a selfish old man. He'll take care of himself before he takes care of anybody else. Thank you very much. I have a pastor friend who was pastoring down in East Clarksburg, West Virginia. Had an old van. He was out picking up kids for Sunday school one morning. Pulled up in front of a house where only little Johnny was going to come to church. And the screen door flies open. Johnny comes running down the steps, taking 2 steps at a time, on down the walk, some more steps. The side of the van is open, and little Johnny, he hops through the side of the van and jumps in and gets ready to sit down. And just as he comes through the door, he's carrying 2 cookies. And he lost his grip, and one of those cookies rolled under the van. While they closed the door and drove off, pastor put the thing in gear. So to make conversation, he said, I see you drop one of your cookies under the van. Johnny said, that was your cookie. Just that quick. If anybody's going to be short a cookie, it wasn't going to be Johnny. Now, where'd he learn that? That's that old man. It shows itself. He's a selfish old man. He's a stubborn old man. He's a get-even old man. You ever hear somebody say, well, I don't get mad. I get even. And they'll just wait. Like a juicy morsel rolling it around under their tongue, they'll just wait for the chance to get even. Settle the old score, the old grudge. He's a proud old man. Have you ever seen anybody that's proud? How do you know they're proud? Well, you can just tell. It's just the way, just the bearing they have. It's just the way they handle themselves. I heard a lady one time went to her pastor with this question. Pastor, she said, is it carnal every time I look in the mirror and think I'm good looking? Well, no, he said, that's just an honest mistake. Pride. And it's not just women that have the problem. In fact, I heard of the old bum who was walking down through the city park one night, just about dusk. He came around this curve in the sidewalk, and there were some evergreens there, some bushes. And 2 thugs, jumped out and grabbed this fella, and they were going to rob him there in the city park. Well, he wasn't going down without a fight, man. Dust was flying, fists were flying, but 2 against 1, they finally got him down on the ground. They turned his pockets inside out, And you know what they came up with? One thin dime. And one of the robbers said, "Man, oh life," they said, "what in the world? Why did you put up such a fight for only one measly dime?" Well, he said, "Men," he said, "the truth of the matter is, I didn't want my financial condition exposed." He was just too proud to admit he was down to his last dime. He's a proud old man. He's an angry old man. Oh, there's some people get hot under the collar. Some people do a slow burn, others just explode. And I've seen them both ways. So have you. The old man. Just ruining their testimony. I remember one time we were in that storefront church I was trying to describe to you. And this lady who was the church treasurer, she had an awful temper. And everybody knew it. It's too bad when you got to have people in the church, you got to give them lots of room lest they explode. Got to handle them with kid gloves lest they go off on you. I called her on the phone. Now, her husband had an excellent job. He was a supervisor. They lived in a beautiful brick ranch home. We're living in this old barn of a place. We didn't have that, but that's fine. We knew that when we moved there. We were hoping to build, and we did build a new church and a new parsonage within the next 2 years. But this woman who had everything going for her, it just seemed like she couldn't handle that temper. One day I called her about something, probably something to do with church finances, and she began to scream at me on the phone, hollering and screaming to where it was just a sound. She couldn't even vocalize words. And finally her 15-year-old daughter took the phone from her mother and apologized to me, the pastor, for how her mother was acting, and she ended the conversation. I mean, her mother just lost it. Church treasurer. Looks like a sanctified woman. One day she came into church Sunday night. This is the lady who said, "I'll forgive you, but I'll be a long time forgetting it." She had lots of problems, I guess. The church service had ended that evening. Now we had, like you have, nice brass offering plates. This little church didn't have anything going for it, but we had a pair of nice offering plates that some other church had bought us, and we had a nice communion set. We couldn't do much else with much class, but well, we can sure take up a good offering. I mean, we sure had the nice plates to do it. And that night, there was probably just a lot of silver and copper in that plate, just a little crowd of a few dozen people. That noisy floor I told you about, vinyl floor, metal seats. She was standing back at that corner, and I was down here talking to somebody, and all of a sudden I heard bang. And I looked up, and she had taken those two offering plates, complete with the money still in them, and threw those things like two frisbees out over that pile of all those steel chairs. Bang, crash, bang, they kind of rolled along and fell down, and those quarters are rolling all over the place. You know how quarters do, and they go round and round, finally they stop going around, you know. And she turned on her heels and stomped across the back of that church, opened that door, and went out and slammed that heavy lid glass door. I held my breath to see if the glass would stay in the molding. Slammed the door. Now, I think she was upset. I really do. And then I got thinking about back in the Pentateuch, in the book of Leviticus, Moses had spoken about a heave offering. But I don't think that's what Moses had in mind. It was totally different from that kind of heaving. I say he's an angry old man. He's impatient. He's easily offended. He's critical. He's fault-finding. He's fearful. He's stubborn. Now, I don't know if I've taken a picture of any of your attributes this evening or any of your friends' attributes. I say again, we can spot these in the other people so much faster than we can see them in ourselves. But I'm here to tell you tonight that God has a deliverance for you where you don't have to go on living with that kind of what we call the fifth columnist of the soul. You know what that term means? I ask my students, this generation doesn't know the term. Fifth columnist means this. If you're in the military, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, in boot camp you march in companies that are four abreast and usually 10 rows long. There are usually 40 people in a company. So you all know who each other is, who each other are. But they said if there's somebody else marching alongside you and you don't know who they are, they don't fit in, they're forming their own little fifth column. In fact, when I was young, they talked about the communists as the fifth columnists, you know, the traitors. That's the term we use. Well, I'd like you to know that old man or that old woman in your heart, if you're unsanctified, is a fifth columnist in your soul. That old man, that old woman really doesn't belong there, but God can't do anything about removing them without your permission. So what he does is he shows you, through a process of time, some of those traits, and you look in the mirror and you say, I don't like that about me. This is ruining my friendship. This is costing me the confidence of other people in the church. My children don't have confidence in me. Oh, I'll try to put on an act and fool the rest of the people. Abraham Lincoln said, you can fool all the people some of the time, and some of the people all the time, but he said, you can't fool all the people all the time. And I like to add this, and you can't fool God any of the time. All right? The best thing you can do once God begins to show this to you. Now, you didn't see this the night you prayed through at the altar, but now through a process of walking with God, this thing has shown itself for what it is. This is the residue. This is the leftovers of Adam's fall in the garden. We call it original sin. Now, the Catholics teach that when you baptize a baby, that it's sort of original sin. Well, I see an awful lot of Catholics that have an awful lot of these attributes. You're not going to baptize this thing away, friend. This is only going to be delivered out of your soul when you come forward in prayer and ask God to cleanse your heart. There are verses in there where he says, we cleanse ourselves from the filthiness of the flesh. Another verse says, every man that has this hope purifieth himself even as he is pure. Now that tells me this. If you look in the mirror, you look in your life and you see one of these attributes, what do? You go to God in prayer. You say, God, I see where I've got a censorious spirit. And like those stones in that jar, let God take that stone out. You know what? You can hold more water now. He can still fill you up, but you'll have one stone less to deal with. God, I see I'm stubborn. I see how I acted in that last board meeting. I'm sorry, God. I want you to cleanse that out of my heart. And you can work your way down. That's the process we talk about. And there comes that moment when God finally finishes the job, sanctifies you wholly, purifies your heart by faith. What God did at Pentecost for the 120, he can do for you. The testimony of thousands over the centuries has been that God purified their hearts by faith. As a boy, I've sat and listened to the old-timers tell about how God saved them. And then weeks, months, maybe years later, when they've got the light on it, they ask God to sanctify them, and God did. Change them. Now, let me tell you something. I want to clear up a couple of misconceptions. Pastor, it's not 8:30 yet. I'm coming down the home stretch, okay? I heard a preacher one time say this. Big Tabernacle, Stoneboro. Maybe 800,000 people sitting in there. And here's what he said. Listen to me closely now, or you'll miss it. He said, if you're saved, you're my half-brother. If you're entirely sanctified, you're my full brother. And I said, wow, what kind of theology is that? If you're saved, I already said, you're my brother. You're my sister. There's no half. You can't be halfway in this thing and half out. You're either walking in all the light or you're not. You're either saved or you aren't. You can't be half saved. You can't be a half-brother. And then I'll tell you something else you don't do. Here's what I've heard. I've had people in my own church say this to me. Well, they say, Pastor, I still do this because I'm not sanctified yet. Whoa. That sounds like they're walking in all the light, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds like there's something they know is wrong and they're going to still do it under the guise, well, I'm not quite there yet, so I guess I have permission to round the corner a little bit. No, no, no. You walk in all the light. You're trying to please God with every decision you make in life. But I'm here to tell you, based on the testimony of 10,000 saints, God can get you the place where that refining fire will go through your heart. It'll not only illuminate your problem, but that fire of God will burn it out, and you can be entirely sanctified. It's both instantaneous and gradual. The old man is crucified when you're saved, And as a process of dying, when we used to butcher, Dad get the rifle out. We'd lead the old steer out of his box stall and outside the barn. We'd put a lot of nice straw down there because we're going to butcher there. And we'd get that old steer there, and Dad'd get his rifle and shoot him right between the eyes. Bang! He'd fall over dead and kick. Kicking and twisting. We say, what's he doing? Well, he's dying. But there comes a moment then when life ceases to exist. Same thing happens to you. When God saves you, that dying process begins. The process of holiness begins. We call it initial sanctification. Some theologians call it legal sanctification. At that point, you're walking in the light. You'd go to heaven if you died. You can't do anything more than walk in the light that you have. I like to close with a little illustration, if I may. Well, let me first of all tell you about my dear friend who's now in heaven, H.E. Robertson Sr. This man, the first time I ever heard him preach was in his 80s. He was a powerful force for God in our denomination. He led the noonday fast and prayer in the Children's Tabernacle for years and years at our camp meeting. 100 people gathering to pray over noon fast and prayer, and he was always the leader. He knew how to get people to pray. He had been my mom and dad's pastor when they were teenagers. Now he's an old man. The church I was attending when I was in Bible school, they had him come for revival, not because he's some great powerful orator. He's just a godly man with some good sage advice to share with people. And I remember somewhere in that meeting, I remember he gave this little illustration. They were living in Franklin, Pennsylvania, probably in their early 80s, late 70s. He and his wife, two of the godliest people you'd ever want to know. Gentle, soft-spoken. He said, my wife and I had gone to the grocery store. We bought a few bags of groceries and came home. I'd pulled in the driveway, and we got out. He said, this was in the day when we used paper bags, not plastic. And he said, between the car and the side of the side door that goes into the kitchen, he said, it started to rain. He said, my wife had the key. He said, she's standing there fumbling with the key and the doorknob, trying to get the door open. He said, I'm standing there holding these two bags of groceries, and maybe she had a bag. And he's saying something like, hurry, mother, hurry, you know, the rain's getting harder. Whatever he said, it couldn't have been much because he was such a gentle person. She finally got the door open. They got in the kitchen. He sets his bags of groceries down. She was over at the sink, put hers down. He said, people, he said, I turned to walk to my study, which was across the dining room on the other side of the room. And he said, halfway across the dining room, God's Holy Spirit said to me, son. Now he says, I know you didn't say much, but he said, I want you to go back and apologize to your wife for what you said to her while she was there at the door. And again, I'm stressing, it certainly couldn't have been much. I mean, he wasn't jumping up and down, hooping, hollering. He wasn't capable of that. He was too much of a gentle fellow. He got out in the kitchen. He said, I recognize God's voice. Here's new light for him, you see. He's got new light now. He goes out to his wife. He puts his arm around her. He said, honey, he said, I'm sorry for what I said to you at the door. He said, I know you were doing the best you can. Oh, Papa, she said, don't worry about it. He said, I knew you were worried about those bags getting wet. And he said, we hugged or something. And he said, and still having the victory, still having the smile of heaven, he said, I walked back through the dining room and on into my office. And he said, I never missed a beat in my walk with God. That's how it works, friend. It's not saying God won't show you some new things along the line. You'll have to back up on yourself. You'll have to do some apologizing because you're human. You say, what would happen if he had fallen over dead there in the dining room? If he had already agreed to go out and make the apology, he'd gone his road to heaven. Remember, I said the other night, as soon as you give the consent of your will, it's as good as done in God's eyes. And that's the way it works. A man in his late 70s, he's not too big to apologize. Doesn't mean he was unsanctified. Doesn't mean he was backslidden or anything of the sort. Just means he was living close to God. He knew the voice of God, and he wanted to be quick to obey God. Now my illustration. I've already made reference, I love the pipe organ, any kind of a classical organ. Someday, God willing, I might get to Europe. I want to visit some of those little towns in southern Germany or my own people from Switzerland. Seems like all those formal churches over there have big pipe organs. Doesn't take a very big church to have a nice pipe organ. They're all over Europe. One day up in one of those mountain towns where there was a beautiful organ in this church, and the old organ meister, they called him, he was the played the organ, conducted the chorale, and so forth. And he had had many music students across the year. He was good. He was a master organist. And this particular church had a lovely pipe organ. One day at the close of the morning worship service, he's shutting down the organ. He reaches over and he pulls down the roll top, puts the key in there, and he's going to lock it up. And he hands the key to his young assistant, and he says to him, he says, "I'm leaving town for several months." Now, he said, "You'll be in charge. You work with the choir. You play the organ. I'll be back in the fall." And he left. So the young man, his assistant, after all, he had trained him. He was good. He did an acceptable job of playing. And so several months went by. And one day, an elderly gentleman visited that church, sat in the back. Not too many even noticed him during the service. The service has ended now. The young man has played his postlude. People are marching out of the church. And this old gentleman is making his way down the side aisle, heading down to where this organ is. Now the young organist has slid off the bench. He's pulling the top down, and he's getting ready to lock it. And this visitor says, just a moment, he said, "Let me look at that organ, would you please?" Oh, this young man, filled with indignation, "No, nobody touches this organ. You know, the master's given me the key. You know, I'm the man. Nobody touches this organ." "Well," he said, "just let me look at it, please. I won't hurt it." "No," he said, "I'm sorry." And there's a little bit of a discussion going on. Well, a couple of the old men in the church, some of the church fathers, picked up on this little discussion going on down here. So they sort of quietly sort of drift that way and got down there and what's going on here? Well, the old gentleman says, "I'm just visiting your church today," and he said, I'd really like to look at this organ." And one of the elders said, "Well, let him look at the organ. Was he going to hurt it? I mean, we're standing here watching. Open it up. Let him look at it." So with great reluctance, the young man puts the key back in the lock, slides that top back and steps back. And the old visitor just looks at it for a little while, just sort of gazes at it. He sees all those couplers and all those draw knobs and pistons. "Really," he said, "I'd really like to play it if I could." "Oh, nobody touches this organ." "Well," now the father said, "he obviously has an interest in organs. He's not going to do anything to it. What's there to hurt? Let him play a little bit." And again, with great reluctance, the young hotshot steps back, and the old gentleman slides onto the seat, reaches over, turns on the power supply. Those bellows down below start pumping air up through those pipes. He begins to set some registration. He selects a few sounds, and he began to play. Well, it was obvious from the very first chord, this guy was no novice. He knew what he was about. He begins to play some of the most beautiful music they'd ever heard. And he's adding more and more. More ranks of pipes are kicking in. Finally, he's got that thing singing like they'd never heard it. Oh, the chords are just reverberating throughout that big church. And the men are just standing there. People who were leaving just stop and stare in rapt attention. What in the world? We've never heard anything like this in our life. Finally, the old gentleman stopped. Slid off the seat and stood up, and the church father said, well, who are you? We don't know you. What are you about? Well, he said, "Man," he said, "my name is Felix Mendelssohn." "Yes," he said, "I do compose music. I've written several pieces for the organ." And he said, "Early in my life," he said, "I had a hand in designing some organs. And I checked this out. It's true. Mendelssohn did." Now, he said, "this organ was built in a distant city where I was in the employment of a company." And he said, "actually," he said, "they brought me the measurements for this church," and he said, "and I designed this organ on my workbench in another city, but," he said, "I never got to see the installation after it was done. I went on to other things. Now," he says, "it's late in my life." But here's what he said that I liked. He said, "I designed this organ, and I knew what it was capable of." He said, "I just wanted a chance to try it out and hear it." And I heard that story probably 30 years ago. When I heard that, I thought, who designed you? And who designed me, friend? Who better knows what you and I are really capable of if we'll just slide off the bench and let the master get on center of our life and let him take control? I think the world is still waiting to see what God can do through those hearts that will be completely yielded to Him. Who designed you, friend? Who knows you better than you know yourself? God has a work of grace for you. All you have to do is be determined you're going to have it. Not that you have to talk God into it. He's waiting to do it for you.